The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Your family, David, has an interesting history with Detroit. I remember we've gone to Detroit back, you know, through the 1990s. We have clients there. We've had conferences there. We went to Detroit just a few years ago, you, your dad, myself. We saw quite a change, but I remember each time we'd go to Detroit, your dad, Don, would point out that he almost had a career in that area with Dow Chemical. And, you know, back in the 1960s, when that was to happen in his life, and I'm glad that didn't happen, actually, in his life, Detroit was the place to be. I mean, as Detroit goes, that was America. I mean, that was Boomtown USA per capita. I think Detroit had the highest per capita income in the nation at that time.
That's right. 1960, it had the highest per capita income in the country. That beat New York. That beat a lot of your other metropolitan, very cosmopolitan areas. And it was basically at the bottom of the funnel, if you will. Right. Money flowing from across the country and to some degree around the world towards the manufacturing power of this one city.
That was the Car City. I mean, that's where that kind of power came from. But you know what's interesting, Dave? In the 1990s, Detroit still had some potential, but we started to see a decline as we went and were giving talks and doing conferences at the time. The people who lived there, some of them could observe a change. And then the last time we went, I think that was 4 years ago, it was profound. I mean, we really did see such a change. What it reminds me of, I mean, these types of issues, like the city of Detroit defaulting, Dave, it was obvious 4 years ago that that was going to happen. And what it reminds me of is these things that occur are not necessarily something that should surprise us, not just Detroit, but what's happening to the nation, some of the things that are happening in the world. It reminds me of when Sherlock Holmes tells Watson, you know, Watson, you see, but you don't observe.
And that's a critical point because, you know, there are evidences all around us of deterioration at the fiscal level. And, you know, we will wonder someday how shock in the treasury market occurred because it was the gold standard right. of the fixed income space. And how did rates soar so high? Why did prices drop so low? Surely it was a surprise. And I think that's exactly right. People see, but they don't observe.
Well, and let's just bring this into the current market. Dave, we are being told we're in this roaring bull market in the stock market, but every signal out there is telling the person who actually is observing that this is the makings of a bear market, not a bull.
And it is a bet on recovery. It is a bet on recovery. It is a hope for recovery. And certainly the one element there that is predictable is the money printing. We're running out of buyers. We're running out of people to come in and buy the stock market, but we're not yet running out of money because the Fed has made its commitments and at this point has done nothing to reduce its commitments. Meanwhile, we do see housing starts abominably low this last week. Existing home sales, ugly. Frankly, the only thing in the home building front that was positive was home builder sentiment. This is a survey of people who are out there, you know, swinging a hammer and saying, hey, listen, we're building. The question is, are you going to be able to sell what you're building? Because you certainly feel positive about what you're doing. You're putting your own capital at risk in many instances. And I think that there is a degree of hope that it turns out all right, and that the evidence that you've been given by the Fed, by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, et cetera, has been true, has been helpful, has been sort of at the leading edge of what is a recovery.
Well, why don't we then talk about what does a bear market look like versus a bull market? Because we're being told bull, but, you know, the home sales, like you said, declined. They're even revising the May numbers down at this point. So what we were being told was not accurate. What we felt was accurate.
Bear markets reflect a deterioration of confidence. That's really what you have. And prices can either move sideways or move down when people gradually shift or gradually reappraise risk. And that can happen two ways. You can either look at sort of, on the one hand, a diminishment of opportunity.
Right.
Or on the other, an outright increase in risk. And when someone sees an increase in risk of loss, there is a consequent change in behavior, particularly investor behavior.
You talk about greed and fear running the market. You know, when there's a diminishment of opportunity, that's that greed being softened down. But outright increase in risk, which is the second reason, that's that fear response. And that's the one where people panic.
Well, and we've got a lot of people assuming, again, this recovery narrative. Meanwhile, we've got the Keith Halls of the World, and thank you, Alan Newman, for sharing this with us, but Keith Hall, former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, he says the employment rate at 7.6% is misleadingly low.
Well, and he would know. I mean, he was the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He feels it should be higher.
Suggests restating it perhaps 3 percentage points higher. So, you know, the 7.6% as evidence that we're in recovery, and he says realistically it's closer to 10.6. And, of course, we're talking about the U3. If you're looking at the U6, the official stated rate is 14.3. And arguably that could be 3 or 4 percentage points higher as well if Keith is correct in that.
So those are recession / depression levels of unemployment if we just counted those unemployed workers.
Well, as you said, when we look at the stock market, we have observations to make. And the question is, do you have eyes for them? Or are you sort of glossing over those things in hope of the recovery story? We've got mutual fund cash levels, which are below 4%. We've got last week, the largest influx into equity mutual funds since June of 2008.
So what you're saying is, for every $100 that goes into mutual funds right now, only 4 is kept on the sideline for cash.
Well, that's right. And that is an indication of how committed the investment public is. It's an indication of sentiment. And it is extreme on the bullish side. This is where I think, again, you make the observation, when everyone piles onto one side of the boat, bad things tend to occur.
Right.
Historically, we've seen cash levels get to below 4%, and within a certain period of time, 3 years, 2 years, 18 months, 12 months, you have stock market values cut in half. We saw this in 73. We saw this later in this decade, at least twice, you know, where in the year 2000, cash levels got to 3.6, 3.8 level, about where they're at now. And again in 2008, where again, mutual fund managers were fully committed. It was an all-in bet into the equity market. They didn't leave much cash. They didn't leave much room for error. And therefore, the boat listed. Why? Because everyone was in. You ran out of buyers. And that's the strange scenario we're in today. We're running out of buyers. Everyone is all in the equity market. We're just not out of cash yet because we're still getting that steady flow, the unhealthy sort of smack for the junkie flow from the Fed.
Well, and that's where the observation comes in versus just the seeing. We can see that cash levels are below 4%, but the observation comes from understanding that when that occurs, historically,
it means
you're
something.
Getting close to the top of a market.
In addition to that, you've got margin debt, which is slightly off its peak, set in April. We've talked about this before. But it is, in our view, supporting that sell in May thesis. And we're okay with being a day early. You may recall that that's far better than being a day late.
Oh, right.
And that is, again, the idea that when you overstay your welcome in an inflated asset class, it's similar to sort of the thrill-seeking in a game of chicken. You stay the course too long, and it can be hazardous to your health. I think that the one factor in the market that's driving prices higher is Fed money printing.
Right.
If you have a restriction in the flow of dollars coming from the Fed, less monetization, less credit creation, you are defining the course for the Dow towards 12,500, which is about 20% lower off of current levels. On the other hand, you increase the flow of Fed money, and I'm talking about funny money. This defines the course towards 16,500 or even 17,000.
So you think there's some gain still in the Dow if they continue to just flood this market with liquidity?
You're not buying reality. You're buying a momentum trade on the basis of Fed liquidity provisions. And that's it. You are now in the nosebleed section. When you're looking at what is called the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple,
right?
You know, what has been popularized by Robert Shiller from Yale, it's also called the Shiller PE. It currently stands at 24.51. You've had 3 periods in the last 100 years where you did have a more extreme, should we say, unstable valuation. And that was 1929, 1966, and the year 2000.
Those were all tops on the stock market.
They were all tops. So we are either at or very near a top. If you look at sort of this valuation metric, and we've talked about the CAPE before, the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple, it's a 10-year rolling average of the price earnings multiple for an index. That is a very helpful way of knowing kind of what your future projected returns would be. Over the next 10 years, they would be less than 2%, closer to 1.5%. And that includes probably a 10-15% year. Maybe this is that year. Included in that is also extreme negative years, but your average is going to be between 1 and 2% with that kind of a valuation. The challenge is this. If equity prices were to decline by a third, that would bring us back to what has been the mean value for the Shiller PE going back to 1880.
So you're talking about a 10,000-point Dow from the level that we're at right now, Dave.
Yeah. Well, and Alan Newman asks, is that possible? Could we see a one-third decline to bring us back to sort of the average of the cyclically adjusted price-earnings multiple? And he reminds us that when prices have moved to these extreme levels, the corrections have more typically been 50%, not your one-third to 10,000. But we are setting the stage for a Dow-Gold ratio of a 2-to-1. 2-to-1 ratio with the Dow trading at probably 8,500 points.
Okay, and so gold would need to be about 4,000, 4,200, something like that.
Yeah, and this is the course ahead. This is a 2-, 3-, 4-year process for this to occur. Of course, it could happen sooner than that. But realistically, the fight that is being put up to preserve the dollar, to preserve the treasury market, to preserve the financial system, and particularly the very connected financial players, is immense. We should expect it to increase, not decrease. The intensity of the fight will increase as time goes on, but ultimately we see this as a losing battle. Market forces being more like natural laws of gravity, etc.
Well, and like the laws of gravity with Detroit, the laws of gravity will also apply to the United States. Now, one beacon of hope for a lot of money managers is China. They've looked at China and said, you know, China just has nothing ahead of it but more and more growth. Now, we can argue the dynamic of slowdown at this point, but even China, in its communist state, its controlled economy state, Dave, seems to be doing things that actually might make it more efficient, like the interest rates.
And just to be clear, there is a huge weakness in the emerging markets today, and that will continue. And the capital flows from the West are the primary driver of growth in the emerging markets. But to be very clear on China, we are both bullish and bearish. Probably bearish in the short run and incredibly bullish in the long run, which means that between now and a successful outcome, you can go broke 10 times over.
Right.
We don't suggest buying China today, but we do suggest keeping an eye on what are some healthy dynamics. Long-term reforms continue to build a long-term bullish case for China. And this week, you've got interest rate reform amongst the banks and a move that was towards free market determinism as opposed to sort of state-directed outcomes. Interest rates have been controlled and controlled to the extent that you had sort of an unfair advantage. Select sectors in China could get very cheap loans, and that again was sort of the state saying, we are going to choose winners and losers. You are a winner. Here is a way of financing below a market price, and it acted as a state subsidy for that particular industry.
And that's socialism, that's communism, that's unfortunately, that's not efficient for the market. So freeing that up seems to be a very bullish type of thing.
Well, ironically, on the other side of the equation is the U.S. controlling and manipulating rates and choosing winners and losers in the marketplace. And so while China is in fact moving towards a free market orientation of the banking system to a degree, just even this week, we're seeing degrees of moving the opposite direction in our own markets. I see China like the U.S. in the early one-third of the 20th century. That first part of the 20th century, there was great long-term growth story dynamics.
But a lot of hiccups in between.
There was a few financial catastrophes that had a way of wiping out speculators, debt holders, and really cleansing the economy of what, in retrospect, a la the 1920s, was irrational exuberance.
Right.
But steering a long-term course towards financial success and prowess, again, assuming that we've got a few disturbing financial crises along the way, we see on the horizon some 1930s-style opportunities over the next few years. We're talking about buying opportunities where reasonable assets and an economy that has a long-term growth trajectory that is, again, it's declining, but in our view, that's healthy. You move from double-digit rates of growth to single-digit rates of growth, and you may say, well, that's negative. We're seeing declining growth rates. Now, you're moving towards longer-term sustainable growth rates based on less artificial inputs like direct investment from the government and something that is not controlled by the internal workings of the economy, dependence on foreign exchange and business. You're moving in the direction of a service-oriented and more towards a consumer-oriented economy. In China, that will take time. Don't get killed in the interim, but there will be opportunities over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, and that's something that for the listener who just continues to faithfully listen, you'll plan on interviewing and talking to people as time goes on to clear that path for possible investment in China. But
today would be premature.
Yeah, let's talk then about something that doesn't have a long-term growth dynamic right now. Let's go back to what we started with,
right.
Detroit.
Well, it's very significant, and you see this in a National Review report this last week. 40% of Detroit's street lamps don't work. Two-thirds of its public parks are permanently closed, and it's equally important. Particularly in light of the question of this stand your ground law, you know, the whole Zimmerman Trayvon case, the police response time in Detroit, if you're dialing 911, is roughly an hour.
That's amazing. So if you don't know how to defend yourself and you're in Detroit, actually anywhere right now, but Detroit especially, an hour response time.
And by the way, if you're sitting there bleeding on the street, one-third of local ambulances are drivable, two-thirds inoperable. So you've got a partially abandoned city where houses are offered for a dollar and are not finding bidders, even at that price. You've got a population which is less by two-thirds. You've got a third-world literacy rate with adults 47% functionally illiterate. All this from a city that as recently as 1960 had the highest per capita income in the country.
That's what we were talking about. It really was the place to move back in the 1960s.
Well, and what it reminds me of is a book that I'm reading, Collapse of Complex Societies. Mm. Cambridge University Press published. It was recommended by one of our guests, specifically Jim Rickards in his book, The Currency Wars. And this is what you have, the dynamics of collapse in a complex society. And this is just a microcosm of it. It's when you have so many economic inputs that become unsustainable, unbearable, that you have this kind of collapse, literally, an abandonment. You would say, how do you go from 1960s being top of the world to now being bottom of the rung, barely holding on to the ladder socioeconomically? This was a once vibrant city. Today it's decaying. The details we just shared, all they illustrate is extreme cultural and social blight.
Well, I know we're focusing on Detroit. There's a lot of people who don't live in Detroit. They're not going to go to Detroit. But what we can see right now is going to spread to other markets, the municipal bond market, other cities, actually our nation.
Back to that issue of observation. People see, but don't necessarily observe. What elements are in play that are considered to be sort of sacred, yet are at risk in the wake of this municipal bankruptcy? This is what we had last week. Of course, number one, you've got pensions. They're on the chopping block, and this has direct political ramifications. Consider the, just a play on words, social insecurity that is stirred amongst your city workers and retirees. And this isn't your Detroit city workers and retirees. This is throughout the country. Think of the pressure across the land put on politicians to guarantee pension, retirement, and health benefits. If it can be called into question, if the promise of a future income can be jeopardized or somehow diminished in the wake of bankruptcy, what is the political lobby that comes to bear on Washington, D.C., on various representatives across this land to say, you will make good on this promise. We worked our tails off, set aside money for this. We had contributed funds, and this is not only your money at stake, it's our money at stake, and you will guarantee, you will deliver exactly what was promised to us.
Well, and something that was warned about early on, I had a client send me an email today, David. I forwarded it to you, and I forwarded it to your dad in the Philippines. It was a copy of a 2002 McIlvany intelligence advisor warning people of the coming collapse of pension funds in cities like Detroit and other areas and counties and states. It's, again, seeing something coming, observing it, and then maybe doing something about it.
And it's as simple as math. You just have to look at the math and in a very unemotional way say, what does this add up to? In the case of Detroit, you're talking about obligations that date back to the heyday. Manufacturing in the post-war environment, you had the suburbanization of America during the two decades, the 1960s and 70s, that promoted car ownership for every family in the nation. You had Detroit, which again was sort of the bottom of the funnel. It was the center of the automobile universe in the world at that time. And then you've got the administration of that city, a growing challenge, lots of new city employees, they're accruing future benefits. That's the unfunded liabilities, which now hang as an albatross around Detroit's neck.
But isn't growth always the assumption when you have something like that occurring? I mean, look at Silicon Valley and look at the tech stock boom in the 90s. Look at some of the things that are occurring today. There's always this assumption of continued growth at that level.
It is the basic underlying assumption. Future liabilities that you're throwing onto future generations, they're easily justified by the growth and opportunities created by the administrative process. Now, you could argue that there's opportunities created by an administrative process, but at least they're facilitating a way of life and an environment in which those opportunities may occur. And so, you know, that's a vulnerability, future liability vulnerability that society is willing to take on the assumption that you have future growth.
So, David, the pension issue is one concern, but this isn't just a concern for a single city. I mean, these are underfunded around the country at this point.
As you recall, there's not a trust fund that is fully funded. Most of our national pensions are underfunded. In other words, they don't have all the money they need, in large part because actuaries and boards have assumed growth rates on the assets that are in those funds that were common, really, in bull markets, you know, but they've been shamefully, frankly, stubbornly kept too high over the last 13 years. In other words, you're assuming a 10% rate of return, a 15% rate of return, a 5% rate of return, whatever it is, and you deliver a 2% rate of return or a 0% rate of return or in 2008 and 2009, negative rates of return. And your assumptions in terms of future pension payments had a growth dynamic on the assets that had been set aside, and you're moving the wrong direction. You're
shrinking.
They
were assuming bull market growth in the stock market. I mean, remember the S&P. I mean, it has not really performed to the degree that they've demanded over the last 13 years.
No. Go back to the year 2000. We started with the S&P at 1,500. Today it sits at a hair below 1,700. That's about a 13% gain over 13 years. You throw in, generously, 1% inflation rates, and you're talking about negative rates of return when inflation and taxes are factored in. Again, that's arguable.
So it's more than a lost decade, David. It's a backwards decade.
Well, because you're really talking about inflation rates closer to 4, 6, 8%. So, you know, deeply negative returns as opposed to, you know, what in nominal terms the move 1500 to 1700 looks like, a cumulative 13% rate over a 13-year period.
So your point is, it is not just a Detroit issue.
No, it's pension underfunding at a national level. They've underestimated inflation, and there's real-world consequences to that. There is this inability to pay because the pot is not adequately full. You don't have an abundance to pay from, which means that the reality is the pension system that we have is more likely to become sort of the pay-as-you-go type system we have with Social Security.
Well, David, you were on Fox earlier this week, and you were asked, what's the magic percentage point that you should draw out of retirement savings? I mean, when a person's thinking ahead and saying, how much can I take out per year? What's a reasonable rate of return?
4%. There will be years that this requires a draw in principal. There will be years where that's of little concern, but keeping a conservative number puts the math in your favor. Aggressive pension managers have assumed growth rates of 7-9%, and that's the only ability with which they have to meet pension obligations. You know, so this is the issue. We think you need to put the math on your side. 4% is a great number. Today, with pension fund managers assuming too high a rate of return and not getting it, what they're leaving is a widening gap between the funds required to pay pensioners and those actually available. Which brings us to the Detroit administrator. He's very apologetic, but points out it's just the math. There has to be an adjustment to what Detroit retirees are paid. A big haircut is required, but then perhaps that's where the White House can come in. Knight on a white horse, socialize that risk too. Put the American taxpayer in the gap, stepping up with a blanket guarantee of pension assets.
Okay, so what you're saying, David, is a possible prediction is that the U.S. government as a federal whole will come in and maybe bail Detroit pensions out. But boy, doesn't that set a precedent when you've got unfunded pension plans all across the country?
Yeah, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp can't do very much, just like the FDIC can't do very much in the case of more than one or two major banks going under. You know, you're talking about pennies on the dollar in terms of funding and the ability to cover those obligations. So, you know, the federal government would love this only too much because gifts of that nature, not only are they spending other people's money, but it comes with strings attached. You can cede over more state sovereignty and oversight to Washington, D.C. in return for a national taxpayer filling the pension void. That, again, has not been announced to date, but just keep in mind, socialists do see other people's money as a cure-all.
Right. Well, and pension funds are not the only thing we should be looking at this point, Dave. There's a lot of people listening to the program right now who have municipal bonds in their portfolio. And those municipal bonds, that's what right now is being defaulted on in Detroit.
Right. So the issue of Detroit, you're right, contagion, that's of concern. But pensions, we've considered social insecurity bred by non-payment of, or steep reduction, we should say, of pension paychecks. But number two is the contagion in the mind of investors, not pensioners, but investors. Think of the municipal market, sacred. It is that second category, sacrosanct, generally assumed as immovable in the security market. For a fixed income investor who has municipal bonds, you know, these are the things that you like. They're as safe as the day is long.
Well, and not all municipal bonds are created equal. I mean, there are two types. There's the type that require revenue to come in from taxpayers, and then some that pay no matter what.
Yeah, so just to review, the two varieties are revenue bonds and general obligation bonds. And it's understood that the ability to pay coupons on a revenue bond is tied to the source of the revenue for that particular batch of bonds.
Right.
And thus, there's an extra layer of risk in the equation. So if we illustrate that, let's say the sales tax and or property tax from a series of strip malls is directed towards the principal and interest payments for a revenue bond. If the strip mall is vacant, or worse, the owners are unable to keep up with property tax payments, then the revenue bond holder faces a risk on non-payment. And everyone understands that revenue bonds are a little bit more dicey. They depend on the quality of the revenue behind them. GOs are a horse of a different color.
And those are general obligations. Those are the ones that should pay any time.
They're the general obligation of the tax authority, and they're held as a first priority for payment under any and all circumstances. So that's why risk is assessed differently with GOs than other states that you wouldn't want to consider, you know, GO bonds. You look at Obama's home state. It's a disaster. His domestic home state, that is. Currently in the dead heat for first as the state with the fastest growing population receiving food stamps, Illinois is not exactly sort of a bastion of fiscal health. As we've said maybe a year ago, you could fire every state employee in the state of Illinois and take your current payment in terms of payroll down to nothing, and you would still have close to a $5 billion deficit. And I think that's annual deficit. That's on the basis of these old pension liabilities and obligations in the state of Illinois.
Okay, and so we took someone from Illinois and put them in the White House to do the same thing. I'm sorry, that's just an aside. Well, let's go back to how the boring municipal bond market, the person who's retired, who knows that they don't want to pay tax and they don't want to take a risk, municipal bond general obligations.
Again, when you look at a bear market, I'm just going to say this again. Bear markets reflect a deterioration of confidence. Prices can move sideways, prices can move down, but when people reappraise risk, either because the opportunity has gone away or they view an increase in risk, there is a consequent change in investor behavior. There is a consequent change in the price of the asset in question. So you've got the seemingly boring, the municipal bond market. It appeals to both the wealthy investor and the institution alike. Look, you don't pay federal income tax. You've got a tax-free status with municipal bonds. Of course, that's appealing to a wealthy investor. Of course, the credit quality, the boring nature of the bond is interesting to an institution because with a predictable asset, you have the ability to leverage it up and not have bad ramifications come your way.
Well, let's talk about what you're talking about as an institution, because that may sound distant from a lot of people's portfolio, but we're talking about insurance companies,
Dave. Yeah. So, I mean, simple, basic, predictable, boring, low risk, high credit quality, predictable cash flow, low volatility. These are the things that you get with muni bonds. This is a $3.7 trillion market in aggregate. You look across the country. Municipal debt as a percentage of GDP is about 21% today. Compare that, again, going back to the Detroit heydays, compare that to 1960, municipal debt was about $66 billion, GDP was $520. That's about 12% of GDP.
So it's almost double right now as far as a percentage to GDP at this point.
They've increased pretty aggressively. Well, so has GDP. The assumptions that a muni investor has, these are sacred. Repayment of principal with tax-free income. The reappraisal of risk, of course it affects the price, and it perhaps affects the appetite of investors in the future, maybe just at the margins of the market. There was an interesting report came out this last week by the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and they stated that, you know, from 1991 to 2012, there's been 217 Chapter 9 bankruptcies.
Which is what Detroit just declared.
That's right. That's what a municipality goes through, the Chapter 9s. Or roughly, if you do the math, 217 off of 21 years, roughly 10 per year. Unevenly distributed, but roughly 10 per year. With 2012 notching up to 20, 20 happened last year, 20 Chapter 9s, about double the average. You have individual investors. Individual investors have had to swallow a hard pill from the White House this past year. Mr. Obama is suggesting changing the tax treatment of municipal bonds, introducing the idea of a cap on the tax-free benefit. On the other hand, you've got institutional investors. And this is where the NAIC comes in. They're more concerned about credit quality. They're more concerned about ability to pay, more concerned about just the predictable nature of the asset, because it's, in this case, a very significant component in their portfolio. U.S. insurance companies hold about 14% of the entire municipal market. They're substantial holders, 14% out of that 3.7 trillion number.
Well, and you can see that's the type of investor you're talking about. They really cannot take short-term risk. I mean, this is a long-term investment. They want to have something that they can rely on 10 years, 20, even 30 years down as they roll those bonds.
And they do need credit quality to remain relatively constant, because it is on the basis of a certain credit quality that as a fiduciary they can actually hold it as an asset.
So what you're saying is, with what's going on in Detroit right now, the eyes of the municipal investors are on the general obligation bonds, because that seems to be, you know, if you lose money in a revenue bond, it means the taxpayer can't pay the tax. That happens sometimes. But general obligation bonds, those stand in front of the line, in front of everybody, do they not?
They're supposed to. And this is, again, Detroit debt is a sliver of the total, $18.5 billion. And, okay, the haircut is going to be severe, but it's small. It's a small piece of the total municipal market. The reason the eyes of the muni investors, again, individual investors and institutional investors, are watching the GO market is because Detroit is going to be a precedent setter. If you're at the top of the creditor food chain, you expect to come out pretty well in a restructuring
or
bankruptcy.
Which is general obligation holders.
Yeah. Giving up gains for safety, that was a part of your play. You chose the boring, you chose the totally boring because you wanted predictable. Now, on offer for the general obligation bonds in Detroit is 20 cents on the dollar.
So, in other words, they're going to lose 4/5 of their value if they take that offer.
So there's some confusion amongst the broader cross-section of muni investors. What exactly does it mean to be at the top of the food chain? Because 20 cents on the dollar doesn't fit that expectation. That's what we're talking about. The real reappraisal here is for investors that had assumed a sacred place in line in the event of bankruptcy. First in line. To have lost considerable clout and standing. Okay, this is what's at stake in these court hearings, in this bankruptcy hearing. Yes, we've got pensioners who are going to take a haircut. Yes, we want to see what the political response is from D.C. But here in the municipal market, it's not the $18.5 billion sliver. It's the $3.7 trillion muni market across the country where people have assumed a certain type of risk, and they may have to reappraise. If, in fact, they're not first in line, if they're more dog meat instead of top of the food chain, this is a real issue.
So, in a way, this is a Cyprus type of event. If you think about it, Cyprus over in Europe started setting precedent. We're now familiar with the term bail-in. We're looking at Detroit right now. This general obligation thing actually applies to the whole of the municipal bond market.
You don't have to be a Detroit bondholder. It's the reappraisal of risk. That's the topic, once again, when investors lose confidence and see risks on the increase or opportunity on the decrease. You change investor behavior, with the consequence being a repricing of the asset in question. We're just talking about muni bonds here. Yeah, Motown is redefining municipal bond insecurity. I mean, this is the crazy thing. They're proving that general obligation bondholders are not as special as they thought themselves to be, not as protected.
Well, timing is everything. You know, Mr. Obama is now talking about taxing municipal bonds. Talk about perfect timing when you're seeing the potential for loss in general obligations already. This probably is going to have an impact on the interest rate market as well, Dave.
Well, that's exactly right. There's a couple of things that I want to mention on commodities. One, Kevin, I don't know if you remember, you know, maybe it was a high school type thing. There's a tear in my beer and I'm crying for you, dear. It kind of a play on a country song because everybody's crying in their beer. Well, there is a tear in the beer. Miller Coors, that combined corporation, they're after J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. They're after them because J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs have gone into the warehouse business, and they are delaying the delivery of aluminum to these end users, to the point where the fees paid for storage are increased, and it's creating an artificial bottleneck in increase in price. So they're assuming, and this is what they're charging, $3 billion in the past year went to Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan because of an inflated and arbitrarily controlled environment.
So it's a form of monopoly. You monopolize the availability of aluminum by buying contracts and selling contracts and controlling the inventory.
And frankly, this is great. We've got a Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee panel that's going to examine whether banks should, this is according to Bloomberg, control commodity storage, power plants, refineries, because at the end of the day, the bank is in the business of making profits for their principals, not in serving a broader general social good. And we've already seen this with Wall Street firms having to pay massive fines for manipulating energy prices. This goes back 10, 12 years when we had the brownouts in California. It turned out Enron was involved, and you know, there's all this big mess. Again, going back to that sort of deterioration of trust, this is where we saw Enron manipulating and controlling to their advantage. We saw complicit to the crime, Arthur Andersen signing off on doctored paperwork, what ended up being essentially corporate fraud. You know, this is the environment we're in today. Now, Goldman Sachs, of course, they have their statements out saying, no, we're really not doing this. This is normal, et cetera, et cetera. But executives and risk managers with Miller Coors LLC, they're saying, you're costing us a lot of money by manipulating the commodities price. Now, that may be a bad segue into gold and silver, but we have this manipulation not just in gold and silver prices for the benefit of the house, but there's lots of ways to gain an advantage if you are a bankster. And this is now in the news. July 22nd, Miller Coors sees metal warehouse delay costing them $3 billion.
Well, who would have thought that maybe the golden brew would be the one that actually frees up the gold market? Because you pointed out last week, and the charts are attached still to that weekly commentary, that the inventory of actual gold in warehouse just plummeted by almost half.
Well, enough on the gold and silver standard of beers. I mean, what we're really talking about next is gold and silver itself. And I thought we'd share a Bernanke quote from the last week where he just says, you know, listen, psychologically, lower prices mean, you know, things are improving. You know, clearly things are improving. This is from a man who controls the monopoly of money, and he neglects to say that gold has been money for 5,000 years, and when we fail in our project, like every other controlled currency has in the past, it will be money again. That's not acknowledged at all, the role of gold as money. It's somehow like a can of pork and beans in an AR-15 just for a worst-case scenario, an Armageddon, if you will.
Well, and something that's also not acknowledged is the Goldman Sachs and the Merrill Lynch connection, April 12th and April 15th. I mean, very clearly manipulated. This is not something that he could have possibly been ignorant to. Let's go to that clip.
Gold is an unusual asset. It's an asset that people hold as sort of disaster insurance. They want, you know, they feel if things go really badly wrong, at least they will, you know, they'll have some gold in their portfolio.
Is that an accurate feeling?
It's not all that accurate. I mean, for example, a lot of people hold gold as an inflation hedge, but the movements of gold prices don't predict inflation very well, actually. But anyway, the perception is that by holding gold, you have a hard asset that you'll be protected, it will protect you in case of some kind of major problem. And I suppose that one reason that gold prices are lower is that people are less concerned about extreme outcomes, particularly negative outcomes, and therefore they feel less need for whatever protection gold affords.
You believe it's an indication of perhaps psychologically the direction of the economy for investors?
I think psychologically, the gold price going down is not necessarily a bad thing from that perspective. It suggests people have somewhat more confidence and are less concerned about really bad outcomes. But let me just end by saying that nobody really understands gold prices, and I don't pretend to really understand them either.
I think that's the first note of humility I've ever heard struck in his voice. He doesn't understand it. Well, that's clear. That's clear.
So our Federal Reserve Chairman does not understand gold.
Well, is the bottom in? You know, let's watch and see. We've got silver that's 10% above the lows set last month. We've got gold that's 12 to 15% above the lows, and that's constructive, but we'll wait a few more weeks to really tell. And this is why, you know, calling a bottom is sometimes like catching a falling knife. In real time, you have no assurance that prices won't go lower. But in retrospect, it becomes very clear And we have good reason to believe the bottom is in. Our confidence level will grow over the next few weeks and months. We've already shared the reasons why in recent weeks, why this is a reasonable level to hold. Frankly, a retest of that 1250, 1225 area, in essence, going lower again, but not breaking to new lows below 1200, 1184, I think was the intraday low, that would scare the shorts off of the speculative shorts in the market.
These shorts that are hitting all-time highs right now as far as quantity of people betting the gold market down.
That's the futures market. It continues to see those numbers increase with a stubborn belief that we have an economic recovery. It's full-fledged. Gold position is thus unnecessary given the trillions in intervention, the successful restabilization of the economy, zero inflationary consequences. Again, just kind of going back to Bernanke's comment, we're all geniuses now. If we'd only known this hundreds and thousands of years ago, a controlled money system always has positive outcomes with PhDs managing it. Except the historical record is different. Except that every experiment of this kind in the past has failed. And there are no periods which give evidence to that zero inflationary outcome. So, you know, that is, in our opinion, a false narrative. But here's the challenge. It is believed by so many on Wall Street.
Oh, of course. I remember the CNBC interview a couple of weeks ago where you were just openly mocked and laughed at for suggesting that 1200 would be a great point to buy.
Well, I'll raise the issue next time I'm on Squawk Box. But just remember that when you're building a position in any asset class, it's not a matter of picking the perfect price and making an all-in bet at that price. You make multiple purchases at a variety of prices, giving you a solid average cost basis. That is a reasonable way of taking a position. It's the same thing when you're unwinding. Just as it is most reasonable, gradually unwinding a large position at a variety of prices as the asset increases in value. Listen, anybody who's seeking sort of the perfect entry price and the perfect exit price, A, they're a novice investor. B, they don't understand the liquidity dynamics of any market. Easing out of a position at incrementally higher prices and taking an average price on a liquidated position is the best method for long-term success in investing. Bull markets of a secular nature, these take years, even decades. We're talking about secular bull markets, right?
Right.
And we have cyclical moves, which can be counter-trend moves. That's what we've witnessed in recent months and years. 4 to 5 times, in fact, in the last 13 years, we've seen the same exact thing.
David, it struck me the other day again that we've got to stop looking at annual returns. Okay, there's nothing magic about December 31st. And we have seen gains year after year after year for the last 12, 13 years on gold at December 31. It's higher than it was the December 31 before. But that should not matter if you look at the overall trend, the secular trend, not these short cyclical changes. The secular trend is still up, no matter what the end of the year looks like.
You know, it's the anxious and tender-footed investor that rarely benefits from a long-term secular trend, because the counter-trend price moves tend to force emotional decision-making and create a lot of self-doubt. That classic phase of be right and sit tight is a classic Wall Street phrase, and it needs to be more in practice. The bull markets of the last 50 years, they've all lasted 10, 15, 20 years. We had the Japanese equity market. We had the U.S. equity market, tech stocks at the tail end of that, U.S. real estate. These are trends and dynamics. A bull market in U.S. bonds, these are dynamics that last 20 and 30 years. And the volatility that we've seen in the U.S. Treasury market over the last 30 years, those counter trend moves where interest rates were rising and bond prices were falling, didn't change the course over that 30-year period. Just like these counter trend moves in gold don't change the ultimate course and destination of gold at higher prices. We are in a secular trend. Anyone, again, who remains a little tender-footed because of the volatility, it's understandable to feel what you're feeling, but it's inexcusable to take actions that take you and your family out of positions that are so helpful not only here, but into the future. Stay the course.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.